Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. My co-host for today's Greatest Britons episode will be Max Musson from Western Spring, and we will be talking about Sir Henry Redvers Buller, the Devonshire hero who went beyond the call of duty to rescue his men during the Zulu Wars. Jacob Rees-Mogg has thanked the Woke Brigade for reminding Britons of the great heroes in the country's history. The Commons leader said he believes people are now more aware of the statues they walk past and want to learn about them. Responding to a request for a debate on protecting Britain's history and heritage, Mr. Rees-Mogg told the Commons, "In a funny way, the Woke Brigade has done the nation a service because they've reminded people of the great heroes that we have. Lots of statues that people used to walk past and not really notice. They suddenly think, gosh, that's Gordon of Khartoum. He's an interesting figure. I want to know more about him and what he did to put down the slave trade in the Sudan. I think this has helped remind people of our history and that it is a history we can be enormously proud of. That British people did great things in this country and across the globe, and we see that actually in the United States. The United States, when it sought its freedom, wanted to ensure that it had the freedoms that the people of the United Kingdom were entitled to at home. It was a most fantastic history that we should be proud of and celebrate in our statues and in our education. So we should be grateful that the wokery classes have had this effect on improving our understanding of our noble history." And we preempted this, we really did preempt this at Radio Alban. We started doing our Greatest Britain series about September, October in 2019. And it wasn't until last summer that the iconoclasm really began with the destruction of the statues. And of course, we talked about Gordon of Khartoum. He was one of our Greatest Britons. So I do find it encouraging that Jacob Rees-Mogg also looks up to Gordon of Khartoum and sees him as a great British hero, and he's saying here that it is encouraging people to look into our past and learn more about our great heroes. And I wonder whether Jacob Rees-Mogg has been listening to Radio Albion, because it is exactly what we have been saying. So it's good to know that there are still some politicians that agree with us. Well, what do you make of Jacob Rees-Mogg's little speech here in the Houses of Parliament, Max?
Well, I think that there are elements of the British government who are less woke than perhaps those people who are closest to the cabinet, etc. And it's what we can expect is that such people will have views in common with our own. You know, I think it's a mistake to think that the kind of views that we have are in any way strange or extreme. The views that we have and that British nationalists expound are common sense views and views that are shared by the vast majority of the people in this country, certainly the vast majority of white people in this country. And if there were free and fair elections in this country and we were able to go about our business of winning over the hearts and minds of people, then I think that undoubtedly we would have a British nationalist government in fairly short order. It is only the constant denigration that that we come under from the mass media and from the wokerati and the political classes that keeps the majority of the public in a state of ignorance and perpetuates the current sort of malaise that we happen to be in.
I think he's correct as well. I think people have looked at these statues that are being attacked and they thought, well, I haven't heard that name before. I wonder what it was that he did. And I think there's a lot of support now for protecting them. There's the Save Our Statues campaign, and they've been having a lot of luck. Thousands of people are signing their petitions and saying, you know, we don't want to see the same thing happen to our statue that happened to Edward Colston. It's really sort of revitalized people's understanding of our past. And actually, our Greatest Briton that we've got today, I picked him because he's one of the statues that people have been trying to attack. And the really interesting thing about this guy was that this statue was actually built while he was still alive, which shows us just how well he was liked by the people. They actually got together and said, we want to build a statue of this man because he is such a great hero. And they knew him, they worked alongside him, and that's what that they thought so highly of him. They wanted to have this statue built. And when we look at these things that are happening, we do have to look at what the people were saying at the time. And if they wanted to put a statue up of somebody, it's because they were a fantastic person. And they are the witnesses of the time. The witnesses of the time say this was a very good man. So we can't then look back 150 years later and say, we know better than the people did back then, because we're not time travellers. And the whole of history is built around going to primary sources, going to eyewitnesses, and you have to take what they say, because we're looking at it hundreds of years into the future, and they were looking at it at the time. So it's their views that count, not our views today. This whole idea of pulling down these statues goes against the very principles that historical inquiry is built upon. I don't know if you want to add to that, Max, or shall we get into our greatest Britons here now?
Well, I would just add one thing, which is if you go into a court of law and you are asked to testify with regard to something, if you are just relying solely upon your memory, then a certain amount of credence is given to the things that you say. But if you can produce what are called contemporaneous notes, which are notes that you made at the very time that the event happened, and which are therefore a record that won't have been distorted over time. If you can produce contemporaneous notes and read those contemporaneous notes, they carry far more weight in law. And the point is that the views of people like Redvers Buller and Charles Gordon, the views of the public with regard to these people, and the views of their contemporaries, the people who lived and worked with them, are far more valuable as a testament to their real worth than are the views of people who are just looking back from the present day, because the views of the people who actually lived alongside these heroes of the past, their views are like the contemporaneous notes. These are words that were written about them. These are statues that were carved in honour of them, and they should carry far more weight than the views of modern day historians who like to be trendy and woke.
Well, they're the eyewitnesses, and of course, eyewitnesses, it's what they say that counts in court. Well, let's get into our greatest Britons then. Our greatest Britons today is General Sir Redvers Henry Buller. General Sir Redvers Henry Buller of the Most Honourable Order of the Bath, the Most Distinguished Order of St. Michael and St. George, and a recipient of the Victoria Cross, was a British Army officer given the highest award for gallantry in the face of the enemy that can ever be awarded to British and Commonwealth forces. He served as Commander-in-Chief of the British forces in South Africa during the early months of the Second Boer War, and subsequently commanded the army in Natal Province during the Anglo-Zulu War. And as it says on his statue's plinth in Exeter, he saved Natal from the Zulus. And I think this is the first time that we've actually looked into the Zulu Wars. We've mentioned the Boer Wars before, I think, and the rather unfortunate concentration camp idea that was thought up with during that. And it was just a shame that we were fighting against other white people there, I think, with the Boer Wars. Do you want to add anything to this, Max?
I agree with the sentiments you've just expressed.
Well, let's get into his background then. Redvers Buller was born on the 7th of December 1839 at the family estate of Downs near Crediton in Devon, which had been inherited by his great-grandfather James Buller from his mother Elizabeth Gould, the wife of James Buller, who was an MP. And I looked up the name Gould because I thought, that might be a Jewish name. It sounds like gold. And apparently it's a very old British name, nothing Jewish about it at all. The Bullers were an old Cornish family, long being seated at Morval in Cornwall until they moved to Downs. The family estates, including Downs, inherited in 1874 by Redvers Buller from his unmarried elder brother James Howard Buller, included 2,942 acres in Devon and 2,174 acres in Cornwall, which in 1876 produced an income of £14,137 a year.
Wow.
Yeah, and the point of this is to say he didn't have to go out there into the army. He had an income. He was upper class. There was no need for him to actually go out there and fight in the forces. But that was the honourable thing to do. He couldn't just sit there and not work and just live on this income. And that was a huge income that he's got there.
And the estate that he had in Devon and Cornwall didn't rely upon slave labour or anything like that at all. It didn't benefit from the cotton trade, didn't benefit from the slave trade, and it would have been an income generated from the sweat of the brows of the people that worked for him on his land in Cornwall and Devon.
Really good point to make there, because as I say, they have been trying to pull his statue down. Apparently they say, oh, because he has a connection to empire, but everybody had a connection to empire in the 18th and 19th and early 20th century.
In the days of the empire, of course,
yeah,
we did.
Yeah, exactly. He was educated at Eton. Again, this shows he was very upper class. And after his education, he purchased a commission in the 60th Rifles in May of 1858. We've pointed out these commissions before, that this is how people would get started. Normally, they would fight in battles. And we pointed this out before, that people would join the Forlorn Hope and they would be paid for the risks that they took. And then with that money, they would use that to purchase a commission, and then they could work their way up through the military. And he began by purchasing this commission. So this tells us that even if you're upper class, you didn't just automatically get given a high-placed position within the army. He still had to purchase his commission. So he purchased his commission in the 60th Rifles in May of 1858. He served in the Second Opium War and was promoted captain before taking part in the Canadian Red River Expedition of 1870. In 1873 to 74, he was the intelligence officer under Lord Wolseley during the Ashanti Campaign, during which he was slightly wounded at the Battle of Ordubai. And we've heard of Lord Wolseley before. He was the one that went out to rescue Gordon from the Sudan. The Anglo-Ashanti Wars were a series of five 19th century conflicts that took place between 1824 and 1900 between the Ashanti Empire in the Akan interior of the Gold Coast and Great Britain and its allies. The British lost or negotiated truces in several of these wars, with the final war resulting in the British burning of the capital, Kumasi, and the official occupation of the Ashanti Empire in 1900. The wars were mainly due to Ashanti attempts to establish a stronghold over the coastal areas of present-day Ghana, which not only did the British not want, but also the Fanti and the Gar people, who were also used for human sacrifices by the Ashanti. With the final victory of the British, this barbaric practice was put an end to. Buller was promoted to Major and appointed a Companion of the Order of the Bath for his valour during this Third Ashanti War, which took place in 1873. So we see there that this wasn't just about trade, it was also about these barbaric practices that these savages had. They were savages. They were engaged in human sacrifice as well as slavery. They were sacrificing the people that were around them. And with the British winning the war, this human sacrifice was put an end to. And you were telling me, Max, that he was also rather like General Gordon. He was against slavery and did some things to help the people. Do you want to mention some of that or comment on this?
Well, from what I've read, it wasn't a matter of him actually doing something to combat slavery. It was just a matter that he was a person who was really liked by his men, because he always made sure they had the proper equipment. And this has got parallels really with Charles Gordon, where Charles Gordon always made sure that his men were properly equipped. And the fact that he fought in order to get the best equipment for his men meant that he was constantly in conflict with senior officers in the army and people in the Foreign Office, and back at home politicians. And so whilst he was a very charismatic character, whilst he was a very good soldier and an excellent officer, he was courageous and daring and was awarded for that. He was, you know, caring for his men, and as a result of that, he was loved by his men, and in exactly the same way that Charles Gordon was.
I think that happened quite a lot with these people, that they were looking out for their men, and they would come to argue with the officers and with the politicians. And we can see later on in this story, actually, that they tried to make a scapegoat of Buller, which is why it's all the more remarkable that the public stayed behind him. And they wanted to put this statue up of him because they thought so highly of him, because the politicians really weren't too happy with him by the end of this story. But at this time, where he's in South Africa, we'll hear now about where he gets the Victoria Cross. Buller continued to serve in South Africa during the Ninth Cape Frontier War of 1878 and the Anglo-Zulu War of 1879. In the Zulu War, he commanded the mounted infantry of the Northern British Column under Sir Evelyn Wood, where he fought at the British defeat of the Battle of Hlobane, where he was awarded the Victoria Cross for bravery under fire. His Victoria Cross citation reads, "For his gallant conduct at the retreat in Inhlobana on the 28th of March 1879, in having assisted, whilst hotly pursued by Zulus, in rescuing Captain C. D'Arcy of the Frontier Light Horse, who was retiring on foot, and carrying him on his horse until he overtook the rear guard. Also for having on the same date, and under the same circumstances, conveyed Lieutenant C. Everett of the Frontier Light Horse, whose horse had been killed under him, to a place of safety. Later on, Colonel Buller, in the same manner, saved a trooper of the Frontier Light Horse whose horse was completely exhausted and who otherwise would have been killed by the Zulus, who were within 80 yards of him." So three brave and courageous rescues there. This was actually a battle against the entire Zulu army in that area, numbering around 4,000 troops, and there was no chance of reinforcements arriving. In an interview with the Register newspaper of Adelaide, South Australia, dated 2nd of June 1917, Trooper George Ashby of the Frontier Light Horse gave an account of his rescue by Colonel Buller. He says, "It was discovered that the mountain was surrounded by a vast horde of Zulus. An attempt was made to descend on the side opposite to the pass. Corporal Ashby and his little party endeavoured to fight their way down, and at last he and a man named Andrew Gemmell, now living in New Zealand, were the only ones left. With their faces to the foe, firing as they retired, they kept the Zulus at bay. Then an unfortunate thing happened. Corporal Ashby's rifle burst, but fortunately for him, Colonel Buller, afterwards Sir Redvers Buller, who was one of the party, came galloping by and offered to take him up behind him. Colonel Buller was a heavy man and his horse was a light one, and realizing this, Corporal Ashby declined his generous offer. But the colonel stayed with him, and Corporal Ashby, having picked up a rifle and ammunition from a fallen comrade, the two men retired, firing whenever a foeman showed himself. They eventually reached the main camp, and for this service, as well as for saving the lives of two fellow officers on the same occasion, Colonel Buller received the Victoria Cross. Out of 500 men who made the attack on the Hlobane Mountain, more than 300 met their death." So over half of them actually died at this point. And you were saying something, Max, about how he actually went back for them when he realised that they weren't with him or something.
Yes, I think that the main party of the British soldiers had escaped the Zulus, and it was then reported that these other groups had been left behind, and Buller then went back, and I wasn't quite sure whether he went back with a party of other men, but he listening to the accounts that you've just read there, it would appear that he went back single-handed with his horse to pick people up and then sort of carry them to safety, and it was for that bravery and the repeated going back to fight to collect more people that he was awarded the Victoria Cross, which, you know, it's a feature of management in large organisations, and I'm sure the army is exactly the same, that if you have an officer of a fairly modest rank, say captain or something of that sort, then they develop a strong affinity with the men that work under them, because one of the things you learn, particularly if you're in a very stressful situation such as warfare would create, when you're in that kind of a situation, loyalty is a two-way street. And if you are not loyal to your men, then you can't expect your men to be loyal to you. And this is something that people that are born into high office, etc., very often overlook, and they look down on people who are the working at the coal face, so to speak, people who are at the bottom of the social pyramid, and they regard those people as being expendable people, and therefore don't take as much care of them as they should do. But you know, people like Redvers Bulla and Charles Gordon are men who became officers in the army, and through their own skills at soldiery and own skills at leading other men, worked their way up. But they never forgot that principle that loyalty is a two-way street, and that the very fact that these two men were held in such high esteem by the men that worked under them is a testament to that fact.
Yeah, the colonel went back for the corporals, basically. He went back for these lowest ranks, and he went back there on his own without a team. I mean, that's some bravery there. And it didn't stop there either, because the following day there was another battle. The following day, after the Battle of Hlobane, Bulla fought in the British victory at the Battle of Kambula. And after the Zulu attacks on the British position were beaten off, he led a ruthless pursuit by the mounted troops of the fleeing Zulus. This time the battle was against the Impi, who were 21,000 men strong, consisting of regiments that had already defeated the British at the Battle of Isandlwana and elsewhere. Many of the Zulus were now armed with rifles that they had taken from the British dead at these battles, because up to this point the Zulus were fighting with shields and spears, but once they'd killed the British, of course, they could steal the rifles. The Impi had not eaten for 3 days, which must have been a further encouragement for the British to ensure that they won this battle. At 1:30 p.m., Lieutenant Colonel Redvers Henry Bulla and his men rode out to within range of the massed Zulus, fired a volley and raced back, closely followed by a great wave of 11,000 Zulu warriors shouting. As soon as the horsemen had reached Kambula and cleared the field of fire, the British infantry then opened fire with support from their 4 7-pounders, firing shells over the heads of the horsemen, and when the Zulus got closer, they engaged them with canister shot. A small number of Zulus managed to burst into the laager and were repelled with bayonets, while the bulk of the advance was held at bay by the steady British volley fire and artillery. Some of the Zulu force swung right to come in against the western side of the laager, but were met with equally effective volley fire. And at around 2:15 p.m, the Zulus on the right flank drew back to the northeast. So they're heavily outnumbered here, and the British have got their tactics. They want to draw these Zulus closer to them, and with their weaponry, they can fire over the heads of the British and hit the Zulus that are chasing along behind them. I don't know if you want to comment on any of this, Max.
Well, I can't think of any useful comment to make, and apart from the fact that obviously these tactics appear to be very effective, and we have a relatively small contingent of British soldiers being able to take on and score heavily against a very large number of Zulus.
They had quite a lot of encouragement to defeat these Zulus as well, knowing that they hadn't eaten for 3 days. As the right horn made its withdrawal, the left horn and centre advanced towards a ravine below the redoubt and then attacked from the ravine at about 3 p.m. The leading warriors fell to volley fire from the 13th Light Infantry in the south face of the laager, and shrapnel and case shot from 4 British guns in the laager and 2 in the redoubt. More and more Zulu got into the ravine about 100 yards from the cattle kraal where the British were. About 40 Zulu riflemen climbed to the lip of the ravine, and 2 parties took over some huts to the east and a rubbish dump to the west, about 400 yards either side of the camp. The fire of the Zulu riflemen from the 3 positions forced most of the infantry in the cattle kraal to retreat into the redoubt and the rest to shelter behind wagons to the rear. Zulu morale arose at the sight of the British retreat, and the men in the ravine advanced on the cattle kraal, confronted only by fire from one side of the main laager, and soon forced their way into the kraal, fighting hand to hand with the men of the 13th Company. The cattle in the kraal hampered both sides, but with Zulu pressure mounting, most of the British troops managed to extricate themselves and pull back to the redoubt, with 4 killed and 7 wounded. Zulu riflemen were now able to open fire from behind the walls of the kraal to give covering fire for more Zulu that were advancing from the ravine. At about this time, the right horn came on again from the northeast, charging across the north face of the redoubt towards the guns and the eastern sides of the laager. Although attacked on both sides, Wood appreciated that to the south, 5,000 Zulu could shelter in the cattle kraal only 50 yards away, well within charging distance. Wood ordered two companies of the 90th Light Infantry to retake the cattle kraal with a bayonet charge. Led by Major Hackett, the men shifted a wagon from the northeast corner of the laager and formed a line with bayonets fixed. The British charged across the open ground and forced the Zulus back over the rim of the ravine. The troops then lined the crest and opened volley fire into the packed warriors. The counterattack had succeeded perfectly, but Hackett's men suddenly found themselves under fire from their right when Zulu marksmen in the huts and the rubbish dump on the left opened fire. Wood ordered the recall, Hackett sounded the retire, and his men returned to the cover of the laager, losing a colour sergeant and a subaltern, with Hackett receiving a blinding head wound. 44 men had been killed or wounded. The Royal Artillery fought with their guns in the open and poured round after round directly into the right horn and bombarded the huts with explosive shell and shrapnel to suppress the Zulu riflemen. The rubbish dump, which was on the other side of the laager, was also then struck by volley fire, which stopped the Zulu from replying. The Zulus charged again and again with unwavering courage, but the head of each charge was just shot away. More Zulus tried massing in the ravine, but before their attack could get going, two companies of the 13th Light Infantry ran to the edge of the ravine and mowed down the Zulus below. At about 5:30 p.m., the tired Zulu survivors began to retire, with Buller in hot pursuit with his 600 horse. The Zulu continued to jog trot as the horsemen in three columns closed up and attacked, harrying them mercilessly, with mounted troops firing one-handed with carbines from the saddle, before using their carbines again as clubs and then spearing them through with their discarded spears. Another tribe, the Abukaluzi, then arrived and began running with the rest of the Zulu force. Captain Cecil Darcy of the Frontier Light Horse ordered his troopers to take no prisoners, telling them, "No quarter, boys, and remember yesterday," referring to the action at Hlobane where his men had suffered severely. The FLH singled out the Abukaluzi, chasing them as far as Hlobane, and extracted a savage revenge for their comrades killed the day before, with Darcy recalling that they butchered the brutes all over the place, while Buller was like a tiger drunk with blood. Following the cavalry, the British infantry combed the field, killing any wounded or hiding Zulus left, and at around 6:30 p.m. as dusk fell, a mist arose around the Zunguin Mountains, stopping the pursuit. Kambula was the decisive battle of the war. In 4 hours, the British had fired 138,000 rounds and 1,077 shells, demonstrating that shield and spear were no match for an entrenched force with artillery and the Martini Henry rifle. Never again would an impi fight against a prepared position with the ferocity and resolution displayed at Kambula, and despite the Zulu commander trying to get his regiments to return to the capital of Ulundi for a final battle, most simply went home and resumed raiding. The shock of the defeat contributed to a weakening of the Zulu resolve to maintain armed resistance to the British invasion, and Commander Schoenbrugger summed the battle up by saying that they succumbed to superior weapons and the murderous fire of big guns, but they died like brave men and good soldiers in defence of their chief country. We buried the Zulu dead with full military honours. So they didn't mistreat the dead. They knew that they had been fighting against courageous soldiers here. And I mean, he's very lucky that he actually rescued this Darcy the day before, because he was obviously played an important role in this battle here. Have you got any comments you want to make on this, Max?
Well, just that that account is a very vivid account of what was obviously a tremendous battle and a very, as you say, a very decisive battle in the Zulu Wars. And we've had quite some time ago now. I mean, I wonder when the film Zulu was actually made. The film Zulu was probably made well, I don't know, I wouldn't like to guess, but it's several decades ago, and nothing like it's ever been produced since. But it would seem that this particular battle might be a suitable subject for another film in a similar vein, and that would be a sight to behold, wouldn't it?
Well, we need to remember the, you know, the bravery and everything that went on in these battles, and I find it where it's so detailed, there must have been a big debriefing afterwards, so they must have written it all down, exactly what happened, so that we had it for posterity. And, you know, there's lots of this stuff that's out there on the internet. You know, you can research what happened in our past and think this is the sort of thing that young men would get involved in 150 years ago. And what are they doing now? They're just playing computer games. You know, when we had the British Empire.
While people may say that these wars were only won because of the superior technology that our army had, from the account that you've just read out, we're talking about hundreds of British soldiers fighting against thousands, tens of thousands of Zulus. And so it is, each one of these battles was a battle between a small contingent, a relatively small contingent of people who were armed with what would have been cutting edge technology in military terms in those days, against a massively greater force of Zulus who would have been armed with their spears and shields, but many of whom would also have been armed with rifles as well.
And also, you know, there was no killing of the civilians then. This was protecting the civilians, and the point of a battle is to win the battle, isn't it? If you've got superior firepower, you don't hold back and say, well, we won't use our superior firepower, we'll just use bayonets and make it evens because you've only got spears and shields. You know, the point of this is to win the battle and put a stop to the Zulus and put a stop to their human sacrifice, which was a benefit for all of these tribes around. Well, in June 1879, Buller again commanded the mounted troops at the Battle of Ulundi, where the British Army finally broke the military power of the Zulus by defeating the main Zulu army and immediately afterwards capturing and razing the capital of Zululand, the Royal Kraal of Ulundi. British casualties were 10 killed and 87 wounded, while nearly 500 Zulu dead were counted, with another 1,000 or more being wounded. Chelmsford ordered the Royal Kraal of Ulundi to be burnt and the capital of Zululand burned for days, and Wolseley swiftly divided up Zululand into 13 districts, installing compliant chiefs in each one so that the kingdom could no longer unite under one ruler. And that's similar to what we see going on today, isn't it? Let's import lots and lots of diversity so that the British people can't unite against the despots and the regime. It's such an old trick, isn't it? Just split everybody up so they can't unite. Well, Buller went through one promotion after another following this, and he took part in the expedition to relieve General Gordon under Lord Wolseley. He was expected to be made Commander-in-Chief of the British Army in 1895, but this did not happen because the government was replaced and Lord Wolseley was appointed instead, with Buller being promoted to full general. And I'm thinking this must have been what happened after Gordon, because you remember the government fell, didn't it? So the government that was in place at the time, that would have been the one that was going to promote Buller. And because of the new government that came in, they promoted Wolseley instead. Do you want to make any comments on this, Max?
No, I've got no further sort of insights into that. As you've read it all appears to make sense to me, and I can't think of anything else that I can usefully add at this point.
Well, Buller was popular as a military leader among the public in England, and he had a triumphal return from South Africa with many public celebrations, including those on the 10th of November 1900, when he went to Aldershot to resume his role as General Officer commanding Aldershot District, which was later to be remembered as, quote, a Buller Day. So he actually gave his name to some kind of celebration. He spent the following months giving lectures and speeches on the Boer War and was promoted to a Knight Grand Cross of the Order of St. Michael and St. George in November 1900 and received the Honorary Freedom of the Borough of Plymouth in April 1901. When he fought in the Boer War against other whites, however, he did not do so well and was made a scapegoat by the press, who made numerous attacks on the performance of the British Army in South Africa. The matter came to a head when a virulent piece written by the Times journalist Leo Amery was publicly answered by Buller in a speech on the 10th of October 1901. Minister for War John Broderick saw his opportunity to pounce, and summoning Buller to an interview on the 17th of October, Broderick, with Lord Roberts in support, demanded his resignation on the grounds of breaching military discipline. Buller refused and was summarily dismissed on half pay on the 22nd of October, with his request for a court-martial being refused, as was his request to appeal to the king. So the mainstream media have really advanced quickly. I mean, they were the ones that were responsible for the British going out there into the Sudan, because they wanted this war against the crazy Mahdi and his Islamic State, and they manipulated Gordon in that interview into suggesting that that was what needed to be done. And here we see just a few years later that they're also manipulating the war out in South Africa. You know, this Times journalist is, and these this Broderick and Lord Roberts, they're obviously working with the media by this time. And it was the other way around with Gordon. I don't know if you've got any comments.
Well, an interesting anecdote here is that Lord Roberts' son had served under Buller in South Africa, and he'd been killed in a battle, and Lord Roberts held Buller responsible for his son's death.
Right. So,
and also another feature here is that Buller was making a request, was requesting an appeal to the king, and what we've not sort of noted is that Queen Victoria has died and her son has taken over, and it was well known at the time that the king, can't think what his name was, had a distinct dislike for Buller as well. You know, probably as a result of his advisers wrongly reporting things that Buller had done, and perhaps upon the reports of Lord Roberts.
So he really upset the top brass by sticking up for the little guy, for sticking up for the lower ranks. And that is obviously what he was doing, because the public was so supportive of him. Despite this, there were many public expressions of sympathy for Buller, especially in the West Country, where in 1905, by public subscription, a notable statue of Buller astride his war horse was erected in Exeter on the road from his hometown of Crediton, facing away from Crediton to the annoyance of its inhabitants. He married but did not have any children and died on the 2nd of June 1908 at the family seat, Downs House, Crediton, Devon, where he is buried in the churchyard of Holy Cross Church. The entire western side of the chancel arch inside the church forms an elaborate monument to Sir Redvers. In England, Canada and Trinidad, there are roads named after him. There is a recumbent effigy of him in Winchester Cathedral, bearing the words, "A great leader, beloved of his men." And a bronze equestrian statue of him is situated in Exeter at the junction of New North Road and Heal Road near St David's Church on the route between the city and Buller's home at Downs, Crediton. And it's interesting that they're trying to pull this statue down. They're attacking Buller when it was the lower classes that were the ones that really wanted this statue of him to be put there, because he'd been standing up for them so much.
Yeah, I mean, Buller, just as Gordon was a man of the people. And, you know, I can remember when we were talking about Charles Gordon, just marvelling, really, at the things that he'd done, the corrupting offers, corruptingly lucrative offers that were made to him that he turned down because he felt that was wrong. And the fact that he always fought to make sure that his men had the proper the equipment, etc., in exactly the same way that Buller did. And it's a common feature that runs through large sort of organizations and corporations, as I said earlier on, that you get certain people who are good soldiers, and because they're good soldiers, they make good officers, and that then brings them into conflict with people higher up who are political appointees, effectively, very often, and who have got a dislike and a And who disparage the common people, and who disparage the squaddies that have been recruited and that fill the lower ranks, and that always brings them then into conflict with people like Buller, who always fight for their men.
And it must have been a proper grassroots support that he had, because it wasn't just the top brass that were against him. The media were against him, the journalists were against him. So it was the public that supported him and wanted this statue to be made. That we didn't have non-governmental organisations back then organising things. I mean, when they talk about public support for something today, it means that the media have decided there should be public support for it. Or it means that there's some advocacy group that are advocating for it. And that wasn't the case here. It was the people of Crediton, it was the people of Exeter that said, we want this statue to be made of this man. This is a great man. This is a great hero. We want future generations to remember him in a very, very positive light, such a positive light that we got this statue made of him while he was still alive. It's absolutely disgraceful that there are calls to now pull this statue down by people that are newcomers to the country. They're not, they're not the descendants of the people that put this statue up in the first place. It's shocking that that's going on, and I'm very pleased that we went into his life story today, and that we will honour him as one of Radio Albion's greatest Britons.
Yeah, I mean, one last thing before we finish is we mentioned about the Ashanti, and the Ashanti occupying the land, the sort of hinterland beyond the Gold Coast, which is precisely the areas where Negro slaves were captured from rival tribes and then taken down to the Gold Coast to be sold to the European slavers, who then took them off to America. And so, Buller actually fought against the people who were doing the slaving.
He fought against the people doing the slaving, and he stopped the human sacrifice, and he was well loved by his people, a great man. That's it for today's episode of Greatest Britons. Do watch out in the future for more in the series, and thank you very much for listening.